Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does aid to poor countries really make a difference? Over the last four decades, developing nations have received an estimated $2 trillion in foreign assistance, and some critics point to the hundreds of millions who live on less than $1.25 a day as evidence that development funds have been wasted. But my guest today says the focus on individual income fails to account for the fact that many people in the world's poorest states are in fact leading longer, healthier, and more hopeful lives than their parents and grandparents could have dreamed. Charles Kenny is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation, on leave from his position as a senior economist at the World Bank. His new book is called Getting Better: Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Many people who are committed to helping the developing world choose to focus on its crises, perhaps in an effort to convince wealthy people in wealthy countries that, in fact, their help is urgently needed. What is the danger in that approach?
Well, it misses out on the immense progress that we've seen and the immense improvements in the quality of life that have affected, you know, the vast majority of populations on every continent, including Africa, which is the, you know, usual subject of these articles on how everything's going horribly wrong. So if you take the example of Africa, the proportion of Africans who were refugees in 2005 was 0.5%. And the number who died in wars over the last sort of four decades was average 0.01%. And for the rest of those people, I mean, those people, you know, it's a tragedy that they died, it's a tragedy that they were made refugees. But for the rest, for the vast majority of Africa, we've seen, you know, huge progress. So just to take one example, life expectancy in sub-Saharan Africa was just 41 years in 1960, and it had climbed by more than 10 years to over 50 years by 2005. And literacy rates sort of more than doubled over the three decades between 1970 and 2000. And I could go on. I mean, just a huge range of indicators suggest really marked progress in the quality of life for the great majority of people in Africa.
And one reason that I guess we don't acknowledge or recognize that progress is that many people compare it to the East Asian miracle that causes us to view places like Vietnam and South Korea and China as such extraordinary success stories. Can you give us some perspective on the comparisons between East Asia and sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, East Asia saw economic growth rates, which were unprecedented in human history, sort of 6, 7, 8% per person per year increases in income over, you know, 20-year period. A dramatic and hugely important global event, which has really lifted a lot of people out of poverty to, you know, middle-class standards of living. And that is great news, and I don't mean to downplay that. And meanwhile, in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, many countries are as poor as they were in 1960. So, you know, it's not that there isn't a difference between the two. There is a huge difference. But, I mean, one of the interesting things is another region in the world that actually saw pretty anemic growth rates was the Middle East and North Africa, which has been in the news a lot recently. I mean, one of the reasons for all the protests was the high level of unemployment in the Middle East, and that was driven in part by very low growth rates. The Middle East and North Africa saw much more dramatic improvements in life expectancy over the last 30 years than did the East Asian miracle countries. So, according to one measure, that of income, the miracle happened in East Asia. But according to another measure, which is life expectancy, how long do people live, the miracle happened in the Middle East. So depending on the measure you use, you know, it depends on where you think is the most successful part of the world.
So people are living longer today in Libya and Syria than in China. And part of that is because the Chinese government no longer takes as great a role in health care for its citizens. Is that right?
Absolutely. The China used to have a system called barefoot doctors, and these were doctors that got not 7 years training, much less than that. They got a few months training, many of them, just in the most basic forms of healthcare, you know, vaccinations and so on. But those doctors covered the entire country and were part of a huge improvement in life expectancy in China before growth rates started to pick up in the 80s and 90s. Then, income in China over the last 20, 30 years has been growing, you know, immensely fast, and that's great news. But along with that income growth, we've seen the barefoot doctor system break down and universal health insurance schemes break down. And we're left with China spending a lot more money on health than it used to, but rather stagnant rates of improvement in health, because a lot of that money is spent on unnecessary drugs and on unnecessary surgery in a system that's now, you know, largely driven by the private sector and rather poorly regulated.
So, Charles, why are we so fixated on individual income and on GDP as the most important barometers of the progress a country's making?
Partially because it matters, right? If you're living on a dollar a day, which about 700 million people still are, if you're living on around a dollar a day, you are spending 80-90% of that on basic foodstuffs. You have very little left over for more interesting food or for education or for health or for, you know, all the other things we like to spend money on. And you're very close to being in a situation where you just don't have enough to eat. And so getting people richer really matters. The point is, it's not the only thing that really matters. So even people living on a dollar a day see improved quality of life because of the spread of vaccination, because of the spread of free or incredibly cheap schooling, so because of the spread of civil and political rights around the world. So that a dollar today can buy you a lot more than a dollar did 20 years ago in terms of the quality of life worldwide, and that's a huge bit of progress. So income does matter, and we should focus on it. And it's, you know, one easy number to focus on, but it's not the only thing we should focus on.
So we also need to look at education, at I guess rights for women and things like that.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the big improvements over the last 20 or 30 years has been in the rights of women worldwide. One of the I think the most glorious changes in attitudes towards what's normal is when it comes to girls' education. It used to be considered sort of odd. Why would you send your girl to school? You know, what are they going to do there? And it's now the new normal worldwide to send girls to school so that they get an education, they get literacy, and so on. And that has, not only is that a huge good in its own right, but it has knock-on effects. It has knock-on effects in things like child health for the next generation. You know, literate mothers are much more likely to do the right things when it comes to their kids, get their kids vaccinated, breastfeed their kids, know the response to common illnesses like diarrhea, you know, what to do in those circumstances, than a girls who did not go to school. So it's not just that it's a good thing that, you know, girls get equal access just because that's a good thing. It's also a good thing because it means the next generation does a lot better across a range of different measures.
So we look at something like universal education, and that seems to us in this country to be obviously important. But you've pointed out that universal education is a wonderful goal, but it's about more than simply building a lot of classrooms in particular countries.
That's true, and in some ways that's the easiest part of it. The last 40 or 50 years has seen pretty much every country in the world a huge explosion in the number of schools and their spread across countries, and that's hugely important and much to be valued. It is true that what has lagged behind is the quality of education that kids get in those schools, and so we see teacher absentee rates of sort of 30%. You know, those teachers aren't even in school. Of the 70% who are in school, you know, maybe a half, maybe a third are actually making some effort to teach in the classroom. We're seeing very poor outcomes as a result, perhaps not surprisingly, you know, that lots of kids spend 3 or 4 years in school and come out illiterate. So there's a long way to go there. Having said that, it's still better to be in school than not to be in school, and many people are at least getting a basic level of literacy. So we have some way to go in improving the quality of education, but it's great that we've made so much progress in the extent of education, at least.
What does it take to recruit qualified teachers and keep them in these places that regardless, can't be easy to work in?
It's not easy. Having said that, teachers in most developing countries are actually paid, you know, a lot better than other jobs. If you go to developing countries and ask people what is it they want for their kids, the answer quite often is, we want them to have a job in government, so a job like being a teacher. And that's because it's a stable income. It's actually, you know, very difficult to lose those jobs. So, you know, it's a good job to get. So the problem isn't so much that there's no demand for the teaching jobs. there's two sides to the problem. There's the supply of people who are well enough educated to be good teachers. And you see rather depressing statistics about many teachers in school are teaching classes that they themselves would fail if they took the exams at the end of them. And there's also the question of once they're in the school, giving them the incentives to teach. How do you actually make it, you know, in the interest of a teacher to turn up, to be in class, and to be making an effort to teach the kids their lessons? And those are tough questions. We don't have any easy answers for those questions, but you know, some different approaches have been tried. And I think one really important part of the process is good testing, so that good testing that's published, so that parents know how well their kids are doing in school. And that's, you know, one first step towards making sure that there's sort of accountability between the teacher and the parent as to the performance of their kids.
Another interesting shift that can be made is looking simply at where schools are located geographically, because it's great to have this goal of putting schools in all these countries, and there's NGOs and foreign governments that are working on this, but they have to be within walking distance. You know, if you're an 8-year-old, there's only so much time you have every day to travel to and from school.
It's true, although the interesting thing is we've already been so successful in rolling out education. Rolling out schools. Uh-huh. There was a wonderful study by a World Bank economist called Dion Filmer, and he looked across a range of very poor countries where the average enrollment rate was 50%. And he looked at those countries, and he worked out where the schools were, and he figured out the average sort of the distance that people had to walk to school. And he said, you know, how much lower are enrollment rates where people have to walk a long way to school? And he reckoned that if you put a school right next door to every house in those countries, the enrollment rate would go from sort of 50% to 52%. Mm. It really wasn't the distance to school that was the deciding factor in whether kids went to school or not. It was much more about parental attitudes to education and, you know, what other things were there for a kid to do. Would they earn a fair amount working on the family farm or so on? So it wasn't so much about access to schools, it was demand for schooling. And that's only true because governments have done a really pretty good job at rolling out access to schools. So it's not to say that building schools isn't important, it's just that today it's not the number of schools that is the big barrier to getting kids into school. It's other factors.
So we are seeing education rates climbing and literacy rates climbing in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. Why is there a lag in economic development after you have a reasonably educated population?
Well, I think the Middle East and North Africa is a great example to point to at the moment. So there you have a region where the university enrollment rates have shot up over the last 20, 30 years. It's up near 20% in many countries, and even higher in some. So there are lots of very well-educated kids in those countries. They get out of university and there are no jobs. The unemployment rates across the Middle East are shockingly high. The few decent jobs there are go to people who are well-connected, tend to be older, and you know, many of them are in government or in firms that are owned by the army or, you know, closely connected with the government, powers in the government. And so these kids come out of school, they've been educated, but there are no good jobs for them. And the environment is not such that they can easily set up their own company and make a success of it. You know, the regulations are poor and so on and so forth. So one reason for this gap between education outcomes and income improvement is it takes a lot more than education to have an opportunity to make money in life. You know, education is an important part of the story, but it's only one part of the story. And if you get everything else wrong, you're not going to see the payoff in terms of economic growth.
Charles Kenny is my guest. He's a senior economist at the World Bank. His new book is called Getting Better: Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we invite you to call now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Kenny. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's on leave from his position as senior economist at the World Bank. His new book is called Getting Better: Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Charles, it's impossible to discuss this subject without referring back to the ideas of Thomas Malthus. But you write that even as populations have grown in Africa and elsewhere, people seem to be in better rather than worse health. Talk about how that's possible.
So Malthus had this view of the world, which was basically how much one could produce depending on how much land there was for growing food. And so if you had more people, there'd be less food to go around. And so populations would sort of die off naturally. They would not eat as well, and so they would die younger, as it might be. Well, since Malthus was writing 200 years ago, the world economy looks completely different. I mean, agriculture is a fairly small proportion of global output nowadays, and there are lots of other ways to make money. But also, agriculture has become incredibly more efficient. So there's certainly enough food on the planet for everybody to eat a healthy diet. Indeed, nowadays we have more than a billion people worldwide who are overweight. So the problem isn't a limit to the amount of food, although some people don't have enough to eat. That's a matter of distribution, not of the planet's ability to produce food overall. Meanwhile, we've seen huge progress in areas like public health and things like vaccinations. So, for example, just between 1999 and 2005, thanks to an extended program of vaccination against measles in Africa, the number of kids in Africa just in 6 years who died from measles dropped by three quarters, from over 500,000 to about 126,000. So that's, nearly 400,000 kids didn't die in just 6 years thanks to one intervention, more vaccines against measles. And that's just one of countless examples of health interventions that have spread around the world, and meant that, at whatever income, your health is better. And Malthus sort of missed that part of the story. The other part of the story that Malthus missed was, it turns out that if kids survive, parents don't want to have as many kids. That he thought that parents just wanted to have, six, seven kids, and that was just the way they were. It turns out that parents make a calculation about how many kids they have, partially dependent on how many kids they think will survive to adulthood. And as child health has improved worldwide, fertility rates have fallen through the floor, because parents can say, I'll have two or three kids and those kids will survive to adulthood. I don't need to have five or six kids in order to make sure that two or three survive long enough to look after me in old age, as it were. And so there's been this sort of virtuous cycle between improvements in child health and falling fertility, which has really just sort of made the whole Malthusian story of the way the world works look incredibly dated.
And it's really interesting, because we tend to have a short memory for the fact that Europe and certainly the U.S. even 100 years ago looked a lot more like the developing world does today. Looking, though, at the developed world as a framework, what do we know about the delay between decreasing child mortality and falling birth rates per woman?
It can be sort of as long as 20 or 30 years. The good news is it started everywhere. That, as I was saying, the quality of life and health, quality of health in Africa has been improving for at least that long. And so we are already seeing declining fertility in Africa. It'll take a bit of time to get down, near to Western levels. We may not even want it to go that far, because in much of the West, populations are actually falling. It'll take a little time to drop to that level. But if we continue to see the rates of progress that we've seen in child health in Africa, it's not going to be too long in the future until, worldwide the standard is two kids, or two or three kids, or one or two kids, rather than five or six.
So what do we need to do to ensure that the money we do apply to foreign aid is being spent in areas like education or like vaccinations, programs that we are certain actually have a positive impact?
Well, talk to your representative and talk to your senator, I guess. But the sort of the bigger answer is that one thing is we know that a lot of aid money is wasted. Some of it's just spent on the wrong things, but some of it goes missing because of, you know, corruption or mismanagement. The point is that a little bit of money goes a long way if spent on the right things. So to take perhaps the classic example from public health, smallpox killed between 300 and 500 million people in the last century. It shouldn't kill anybody this century. And the cost of the global eradication of smallpox was somewhere around $300 million, which really, you know, just isn't very much money. In one metric, it's the same cost as one wing of one B-2 bomber. So this stuff, you know, can be very cheap when it works and when the money's spent effectively. And so even if some of the money is lost to corruption, and I'm sorry to say some of it will be lost to corruption with the best will of all those involved, and even if some of it's mismanaged, if, you know, only one aid dollar in two or three actually gets through to do what it's meant to do, even so, it can have a dramatic, dramatic impact on the quality of life worldwide. And to take the case of smallpox again, that really was a dramatic impact on the quality of life worldwide, including in the United States. Nobody anymore has to get a smallpox vaccine because there's no smallpox out there to get vaccinated against. And so that's something that, you know, helped the United States directly. So there really can be a return to this money, even though some of it will be wasted, and a global return to that money, including to, you know, the people who pony up in the first place, if you will, the United States taxpayer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Charles Kenny's new book is called Getting Better, Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Let's go on the phones now to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I had a question. How is the World Bank addressing the problem of corruption and the top leaders siphoning off a lion's share of the loans? Another question is how much. Just think about that. Five questions here, and you can address whichever ones.
Actually, let's start with the one you have because we have lots of folks on the phone. Thank you very much for your call, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. It is a valid question. I should say, by the way, that I can't speak officially for the World Bank. I am on leave from the bank, but the World Bank is doing a lot in this area. And one of the things that it has found most effective is publicity. Sunlight is the best disinfectant is the standard line. So, for example, there was a case in Uganda where the government was passing money that was meant to go all the way to schools to provide for, you know, books and equipment at the school level. But the amount of money that they were sending out from the central government that was actually getting to the schools was sort of below 10% because it was being, not all of it was being stolen, but it was being misdirected, if you will, to bureaucrats in the middle levels of government. And so the Ugandan government itself actually started a program of publishing in the newspapers how much money was meant to arrive in each school and having the headmaster of each school put a note up on the door saying how much money they'd got. Hmm. And it was easy to compare the two numbers. And, you know, if there was a gap, questions were asked. And just as a result of that simple intervention, the vast majority of money started arriving at schools. And so one of, I think, the real advantages of the internet is that in countries rich and poor alike, it makes it terribly easy to publish information like that at a very low cost. And so the more we get information out there about what money is meant to be going where for what, the more the people who are meant to be benefiting from it, the more the final recipients can actually monitor to make sure that they're getting, you know, what they're meant to get. And I think that can be a really powerful approach to improving outcomes.
It's also a sort of interesting underground way of encouraging democratic action, even in countries where full, stable democracy is not available.
Absolutely. And this approach has, you know, worked in countries that otherwise are not perhaps the most democratic. And so I think you're right. It's a way to sort of build up people's perception of their ability to make change. And that's a really important part of a functioning democracy, is the belief amongst the people that if they stand up, you know, their views will be counted.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time on the line, we have Susan in Dallas. Hi, Susan. Hello, Susan.
Oh, hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is such a fabulous subject. And I just wanted to, one comment was to say that the more that people enjoy education and don't focus totally on the money, the better quality of life to deal with all the problems that, come, and that's kind of what you're talking about. And my question is, as the Internet becomes more available in more countries, is this being made available in the schools?
What do you know about that, Charles?
Oh, thanks, Susan. So it's a great point to make, that education is a good in its own right. I think that, is something we often overlook. I mean, you know, it's a very powerful force for improving people's incomes, and it's a powerful force for improving their health. But it's also just, it's a great thing to be able to read. And I think that's one reason it's so nice that it's spreading so fast, is that, just that is a, good thing in its own right. On the question of the Internet, it isn't being used in to a great extent in many of the most poorest countries in, schools, because it's quite expensive to use the Internet. You need to have a computer and, you know, a phone line and programs running on the computer that are educational programs. And in many of these countries, the amount that they can sort of spend per student on educational materials is, in the sense, in some cases, in the low dollars in others. So there really just isn't very much money for rolling out computers to every school. Having said that, it has been used and has been used successfully in some cases. I think that it's one important tool in the arsenal. It's probably not the most important tool for the very poorest countries, but you know, Turkey, for example, has rolled out internet access to pretty much every school and every kid. So depending how poor you are, it could be a more or less useful tool.
So it's sort of a hierarchy of needs. If you're in a village without electricity and clean water, you're better off with a well and a windmill than you are with an internet kiosk.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is that you, your hierarchy of needs approaches, I think, is absolutely right. But what we have seen is the mobile phone has gone up the hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
That now, you know, there are, I think, about 4 billion people worldwide have a mobile phone subscription. Just it's spread out incredibly rapidly, incredibly fast to the very poorest countries. And in developing countries, people use mobile phones for a lot more than they do even in the States. So they're a tool to transfer money. They're a tool to teach literacy. They're a tool to get basic health messages out there, you know, text reminders to make sure that pregnant women take their iodine supplements and so on. It's turned into this very powerful tool that is perhaps more appropriate at very low incomes than thinking about sitting in front of a computer wired up to a broadband connection. But, you know, the mobile phone has turned out to be the information and communications technology that really can.
And that comes back again to your focus here in the book about the spread of ideas sometimes being as important as the spread of anything else, including physical resources.
Absolutely. I think there's sort of two sides to the story of development going on, even in places that aren't seeing any income growth. And one side is the supply issue, new vaccines and so on. But the other side is the demand side, that the people are demanding services they didn't used to. They are demanding that their kids go to school. They're demanding that they have some say in the way their government is run. They are demanding that there's some quality to the education their kids get. They're increasingly demanding that the police don't constantly ask them for bribes. And that side of the story is hugely important. Just to take the education example again, a survey about 10 years ago of poor people in various countries came up with the finding in Burkina Faso that many people said, we don't want to send our girls to school because it's the fastest way for a girl to end up a prostitute.
Hmm.
And the good news is that attitude is dying out everywhere. As I mentioned earlier, it's the new normal that you send your girls to school. And so that kind of change in attitude has an immense impact on the quality of life.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phones to Hillsborough, and we'll speak with Thao. Hi, Thao.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I have a comment. I still say that what we, as far as aid to the third world, I still call it as a failure. It's wrong to say that nothing achieved from all the aid, but for the scale of money that we donate and for what to show for, it's a failure. And the lesson is, well, let's not stop donation, but change the way we help, which means, for example, instead of giving grant to the government and said you invest in encourage free enterprise. A lot much is said about corruption, which is plenty in the third world, but people don't pay attention to. Many of them had the socialist mentality that too much regulation, too much central planning, that you give money and they do wrongly. Anyway, that's my comment.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Do you want to comment on that, Charles?
Yeah, Val makes a point that, again, too much of aid resources are wasted. But the stuff that isn't wasted, I think, really can have a dramatic impact. And when we talk about the amount of money we spend on development, I mean, let's remember that for the U.S. federal government, I think it's 0.1% of the federal budget goes to aid. And when you look at it on a per person basis in the developing world, it's a dollar or two per person per year. I mean, it's really not very much money at all that we are spending, given the number of people that are in developing countries and the amount that we spend. So I think it's quite impressive, actually, that we're seeing what impact we do of aid, given actually it's not a very large sum of money. I do think, Val is right, though, that thinking that you're just handing the money to the government is going to solve all the problems is wrong. I think everybody now agrees that the role for the private sector, especially when it comes to creating income, but also the role for the private sector in health and education and so on, is much larger than we perhaps used to think as a rule. And so there is a big role for trying to work with not just government, but also with non-government organizations and the private sector in order to improve quality of life outcomes in the developing world.
Charles Kenny is my guest. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's on leave from his position as a senior economist at the World Bank. His new book is called Getting Better: Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. We will take more of your calls, more of your emails after the break. Email address is think@kera.org. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Kenny. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called Getting Better: Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Charles, until now we have talked about aid coming from wealthier countries and from NGOs into poorer countries. What sort of benefit could we provide to those countries if the wealthier states of the world simply made provisions to allow more people to emigrate from very poor countries to wealthier countries?
I think the impact could be huge. It's the most reliable way to turn somebody from a poor person with bad health to a rich person with better health is to allow them to move from a poor country to a rich country. So the scale of the impact could be immense. If you look at people who are doing exactly the same job with the same level of skills, but they're doing it in a country like India or Mexico, and all you do is you move them to the United States, you can increase their incomes tenfold. And they send a lot of that income back to their family in the country from which they came. So it has a knock-on effect in terms of improving incomes in that country. But also, the mere fact that they've moved from a poor country to a rich country and made so much money doing it creates increased demand in their home country for education so that other people can follow them out to a rich country. So it has income impact and education impact back in the home country, and has a dramatic impact on the quality of life of the immigrant and their family themselves. It's really just a strong win from that point of view.
Of course, we're often delighted to receive, you know, doctors and engineers from these other countries. Do we have to be careful about not absolutely opening the floodgates to brain drain from those places?
Brain drain is a concept that is very much loved by people who are trying to come up with a nice way to shut the gates on people coming into the country. The actual evidence for it is remarkably weak. And that's for the simple reason that if people are allowed to emigrate, it creates the demand for more emigration from the countries from which they came. So take the example of the Philippines and nursing in the Philippines. Philippines is the biggest exporter of nurses in the world. It has, back at home in the Philippines, more nurses per person than we have in Britain. And the reason is that a whole load of people have seen that if you get a nursing degree from the Philippines, you can go off and, you know, make lots of money working in hospitals from the United States to Britain to, you know, Saudi Arabia. You can make a lot of money doing that. And so it's created an immense demand for places in nursing schools in the Philippines. And so the number of nurses in the country has risen dramatically as a result. So this sort of idea that there's a fixed stock of the number of nurses or doctors in a country, that if the United States takes three of them, they're going to be less left back at home, is just not right. If the United States creates a demand for more people to get nursing degrees, people will go out and get more nursing degrees.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here to think@kera.org from Sam. Sam wants to know, Charles, would you advocate a United States of Sub-Saharan Africa, somewhat like the EU?
I think that could help. Sam's question is an interesting one, and one debated by the African Union quite often. If you put the economies of Africa together, I think this is excluding South Africa, but if you put the rest together, they're still smaller than Belgium. African economies really are individually quite teeny. And that can be a problem. I don't think it is the problem for African growth. Lots of very small countries have been very successful. Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, think of the various Caribbean islands that have done very well, despite the fact they're really rather small places. So it doesn't need to be a barrier to becoming really quite rich. But if coming together as a closer union was a way for African countries to adopt common regulatory standards, as it might be, and make sure that a qualification that you got in Ghana was recognized in Nigeria. Surely it would be a way to improve both the quality of people's lives and the economy of the region as a whole.
My guest this hour is Charles Kenny. His new book is called Getting Better, Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. It must have been exciting for you. We should say that Bill Gates is an unabashed fan of your work and of this book in particular. Did you work with him during the time that you were working on it and say you ought to check this out? Did he find it on his own? Can you talk a little about that?
It was a delightful surprise, I have to say. We didn't talk about the book at all until... I have never actually talked to Mr. Gates himself about the book, but I've talked to a number of his staff. I think it was a combination of things. The Center for Global Development actually is a recipient, as is New America Foundation, of Gates Foundation money. So, you know, there's a channel of communication, if you will, between the places I work and the Gates Foundation. But I can honestly say I don't know exactly how he got hold of the book. I'm delighted that he did, and obviously I'm delighted that he liked it. He has been very generous in praise.
Is there anything about the Gates Foundation that you think, obviously a lot of people are trying to apply some of the ways that they're doing business throughout the world. Is there anything that you would change if you had the ability to do so?
I went to talk to them about that a month or two ago. I think that the Gates Foundation's focus on technology And in particular, health technologies is a great one. I think some of the work they're doing on things like a malaria vaccine is wonderful. I did mention to them that one of the things that I found in the research that I did for the book was the importance of the demand side. So even if you come up with a vaccine that is going to prevent potentially millions of child deaths, you need to make sure that parents actually bring their kids to get vaccinated. And that's not always as straightforward as one might imagine. I mean, you know, we might think that if somebody came up with a vaccine for malaria, obviously everybody in sub-Saharan Africa in a malaria district would rush to the nearest clinic to get it. That turns out not to be the case. And there are ways to encourage people to get their kids vaccinated, and approaches have been tried, including just giving everybody who brings a kid to get vaccinated, giving them a bag of lentils was one approach that was tried in India. So simple ways of encouraging people to do the right thing, if you will. And I did suggest to them that that may be an area they wanted to do some more work in to sort of complement their work on the supply side of development, you know, creating these vaccines. Also think a little bit about the demand side, the making sure people use them.
Obviously, there is the problem, and you've acknowledged this, that in some places, corruption skims a certain percentage of foreign aid away from the causes that it's meant to alleviate. Is there any benefit to directly sort of handing money to people who are dealing with extreme poverty and saying, spend this on what you think you need?
Yes, absolutely. The few places where we've seen exactly that approach tried, which is just handing money to poor people, their nutrition improves, the chances that the kids are in school goes up, the chances that they're creating their own enterprise goes up. So it can have a huge impact, not just on sort of immediate consumption, but also on long-term development outcomes. And I do think that's an approach we ought to be thinking about more broadly.
What, do you think people are concerned about that because there's a sort of elitist assumption that the poorest of the poor would simply not make good choices?
Poor people, like everybody else, don't always make the right choices. And surely some of the money will go to things that we'd rather not subsidize. So, for example, if you look at poor people even not getting any money from anywhere else, just spending their own money, you know, in some parts of the world they're spending 8-9% on things like tobacco and alcohol and parties. So some of the money will be spent on things other than we would like. Having said that, 70-80% is probably going to be spent on things like getting better nutrition, on things like putting kids in school, and on things like buying some basic health care. So, yeah, there'll be waste there too, if you will. Poor people won't spend all of their money on worthy things, but they'll spend some portion of it on worthy things. And when they're that poor, just a little bit more money on health or education can make a huge difference to the quality of life of themselves and their kids.
We also have here the question of sustainability. You remind us that increasing the incomes of the poorest 650 million people on the planet by 100%, doubling their income, would use about the same resources as giving an extra 1% to the richest 650 million.
Yeah. The problem of the fact that we are using the world's resources, you know, faster than they can be renewed is not a problem of people living on $1, $1.25 a day. It is a problem of us. It is a problem of the United States, of Western Europe, of Japan. We are the ones who are consuming at such an incredible pace and, you know, using up all the aluminium and pumping out most of the carbon dioxide and so on and so forth. So if you're worried about sustainability and you're listening to this program, take a look in the mirror. Do not blame poor Africans for the problem.
Are we getting better at figuring out why certain programs work and how they work and making sort of subtle adjustments accordingly?
Yes, somewhat. There's, I think, a lot more effort going into careful evaluation of what works and what doesn't, particularly in the aid arena, which is not to say we have the answers or indeed will ever have firm answers to what works or what doesn't. I mean, if you listen to any discussion in the United States over what gets crime rates down, you'll know that you can be spending a huge amount of money on research and not have a firm answer about exactly what works and what doesn't. But, you know, we get better ideas. So the broken windows approach to crime in the United States of not allowing small crimes to slip by, it does seem actually to have an impact on overall crime rates. The same kind of broad lessons we're learning in development about the kind of things that can work and the kinds of things that don't.
In this country, we talk a lot about the gap in wealth between the wealthiest and the poorest. But there are people who believe that the wealthiest will create jobs and opportunities for people at lower income levels to benefit. First of all, is that the case in very poor countries where suddenly we see an income gap widening between the wealthiest and the poorest citizens?
Well, I mean, I think you've almost answered the question. The income gap is widening between the wealthiest and the poorest. If giving rich people more money was the answer to poor people getting rich, we wouldn't see a widening gap. So I think there is a lot more to the story than just having wealthy people. Although having wealthy people can't hurt, right? It's good to have somebody spending lots of money. But the fact of the matter is, I think you do need to have a broad-based approach. It can't just be a matter of trickle-down. Many of these countries have really dramatic differences in the quality of life between the richest and the poorest. And the way a country like Brazil, for example, has dealt with that is by rolling out really rather large cash transfer programs to give poor people more money. And again, we've seen these results in terms of what that does, education and health and creating their own small enterprises, has a really dramatic impact on the sustainable quality of life of poor people. So the answer can't just be low tax rates for the rich. That is not going to drag poor Brazilians out of poverty.
How does the role of the local and regional government start to change as countries transition and are no longer among the very poorest, but move into the sort of middle realm of income and of well-being?
Well, hopefully they do more. I mean, in the perfect world, in the very poorest countries, governments would have a laser focus on the very simplest of things that governments can do to improve quality of life. So making sure there's some level of security, there's not a civil war going on, making sure that things like vaccines are rolled out and basic primary education is rolled out. As countries get richer, you'd sort of add to the policy agenda, if you will, improving quality of life through things like regulating land use. It's not actually the way things work in real life. All governments try and do all things, pretty much. But I think there is a wider role for government in countries where there's greater wealth and greater capacity within governments to deliver services.
Is there any way to sort of externally promote democracy?
Democracy is going to always be basically a result of internal processes of people in a country making the decision that it is right that everybody has a say in government and who is leading them. But that doesn't mean there's no role for outsiders. I think that what we've seen, again, in the Middle East and North Africa is partially driven by the fact that people are learning, you know, democracy seems to work everywhere else. Why not here? So the spread of ideas across borders, I think, has been an important factor in encouraging the idea that democracy is normal for the Middle East. You can't explain why Egypt happened just after Tunisia without thinking that, you know, outside factors can have a role in promoting democracy.
Charles, I'm afraid we're out of time. Charles Kenny's new book is called Getting Better, Why Global Development is Succeeding and How We Can Improve the World Even More. Charles, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.